At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Time once again for our long-running game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking?
I think that's a great question. I appreciate your asking it.
I know, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 15th of March. This one's a Wednesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so to come clean, Fed Chair Janet Yellen doesn't necessarily think my question is a good one, although she might, we don't know. She was asked at her post-Federal Open Market Committee meeting today, at which we should mention the target for the federal funds rate, that is the short-term rate the Fed controls, was raised by a quarter percentage point to a range of 0.75% to 1% even. Anyway, Chair Yellen was asked, with today's hike, what the Fed's message to consumers is.
The simple message is the economy is doing well.
That was 4 seconds of an answer that, believe you me, went a minute and 37 seconds. You felt every moment of it. All the while, she was saying basically the same thing. Jobs are good. Inflation's good. We're going to raise rates gradually. Nothing to see here. Move along. It is worth a note that Chair Yellen was asked a couple of times about what the impact of fiscal policy might be on this economy. Fiscal policy being what Congress and the president do, government spending, tax cuts, all of that. Truth be told, she danced around that question a little bit.
We recognize that there is great uncertainty about the timing, the size, the character of policy changes that may be put in place, and don't think that that's a decision or a set of decisions that we need to make until we know more about what policy changes will go into effect.
May 2nd and 3rd is the next meeting. We will meet you back here for that one. On the fiscal policy side, by the way, President Trump went to Detroit this afternoon, said he was going to boost American industries, cars today in particular. The president has ordered the EPA to have another look at fuel economy standards that were finalized right before President Obama left office. Have another look here, meaning roll back. Those tighter mileage and emission standards were set to go into effect by 2025. Marketplace's Jed Kim has more on that from the Sustainability Desk.
Car makers say if they have to meet the standards on the books for 2025, their bottom lines will crash. Part of that's the difficulty and cost of technical advances. Part of it's consumer behavior.
When gas prices are low, as they are now and have been for a while, people tend to buy a larger vehicle than they would otherwise buy.
Kristen Gichek is with the Center for Automotive Research.
There'll be greater emissions if more people are buying larger vehicles that are less fuel efficient and create greater emissions.
That's where federal rules come in. They curb those tendencies by forcing vehicles themselves to pollute less, regardless of what we buy and drive. Roland Huang is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Carbon pollution standards and fuel economy standards are absolutely critical to making sure to continue that push. And furthermore, of course, the U.S. auto industry doesn't fall behind on that global push to advance clean cars.
Barry Rabe teaches public policy at the University of Michigan. He says rolling back standards to help automakers now could come at a cost later, especially if the rest of the world continues to innovate on clean cars.
What is the future of national and global markets for vehicles going to be not just in a year or two with low gas prices, but 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
U.S. automakers are giddy about all the trucks and SUVs they've been selling recently. A rollback would help them continue that. But Huang of the NRDC says not so fast. He promises a, quote, long, bumpy road for rolling back the standards, with lawsuits from groups like his acting as the potholes. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the words you're looking for here are priced in, as in traders had already priced in the Fed's interest rate increase. And still, though, they wanted more up, up, and more up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Trade, and specifically getting tough on it, and even more specifically getting tough on China over trade, is and has been since campaign one of the big items on the Trump administration's agenda. President Trump has said, among other things, that he would label China a currency manipulator, that he would slap a 45% tariff on Chinese imports, and that he would go after the dumping of cheap stuff on the world market that the president says is China taking jobs away from American companies and workers. Them's fighting words, global trade-wise, and today Chinese Premier Li Keqiang said China doesn't want to see a trade war with the United States, but if it did happen, Li says, oh, it would hurt American companies. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman at our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting to handicap that one.
To be clear, neither the U.S. nor China has done anything significant to punish the other on trade since President Trump took office. But Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says if the U.S. were to impose big punitive tariffs on Chinese imports, China's got a lot of potential targets for retaliation.
They import well over $100 billion a year from us. Much of that is agricultural products that could be shifted easily to other suppliers.
Barry Bosworth at the Brookings Institution adds U.S. aerospace giant Boeing to the list. China can buy planes from European rival Airbus instead. But he says it's clear who loses the most from higher import tariffs.
Consumers do. We get a big increase in consumer prices.
On pretty much anything we buy that's made in China, from toys to iPhones. But Bosworth says U.S. companies aren't likely to move that production back home.
In the case of Apple, there's lots of other countries that look like China. You could move your production to Vietnam because it's even cheaper.
A trade war would hurt the U.S., but it would hurt China more, says University of Maryland economist Peter Morisi.
Because the Chinese economy is very dependent on the U.S. market for its prosperity. Americans might suffer from a shortage of toasters temporarily until they figure out how to make them for themselves again. But the Chinese would suffer from a shortage of jobs that would pop their eyes.
All the experts I talked to predict an escalation in trade tensions would most likely start with U.S. actions against China over specific products like auto parts, textiles, furniture, or electronics. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Staying on trade here for a second, one of the tax plans floating around in Congress right now is something called the Border Adjustment Tax. In a very, and I do mean very quick nutshell, it would raise taxes on imports and give a big tax break to exports. The idea being to force American companies to use more American products and labor, except for one potentially ginormous problem, international law. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
So let's say we live in a world where the border adjustment tax exists. And let's say we have two U.S. car manufacturers. One uses American steel. The other uses Korean steel.
The one that uses American steel, when they export, they can deduct the cost of supplies and the wage bill.
So that's cool. You get a big write-off on your taxes if you use American materials in your exports. This is Petros Mavroidis, by the way. He teaches law at Columbia.
The company that uses Korean steel cannot deduct the cost of supplies or the wage bill.
Okay, so that's not cool if you use imported materials. It would come out to be a 20% tax on imports under the GOP plan. So to recap, more taxes if you import, less taxes if you export. And you can see what the whole point of this is.
You incite the American company to essentially buy local.
So that's the border adjustment tax in a nutshell. One problem.
It's illegal.
That is the argument of William Klein, senior fellow emeritus at the Center for Global Development. Illegal at the World Trade Organization, where other countries can take us to court.
The basic concept of the agreements we've reached in WTO are that imports are supposed to be treated equally with the domestic product.
The U.S. has been making this argument that you can't discriminate against foreign goods since 1947. From a purely economic standpoint, though, a border adjustment tax discriminates. But the legal argument will probably turn on something much more technical. Hold on to your socks now. Taxes. Under WTO rules, some tax breaks for exporters are okay and others are not.
And I think that's where the argument will end up going on very detailed ground.
Mark Warner is a principal counsel at MAAW Law in Toronto.
I think that it would be a difficult case for the United States to win, but it's not an impossible case because it would be a very technical legal grounds.
Still, he says it's an open invitation for the world to sue.
A lot of European commentators are saying that this is a slam dunk. If the United States brings this in, they will challenge it immediately and they'll win.
Now, the way the WTO works is that if you're found guilty of throwing up trade barriers on another country, then the other country gets to punish you with trade barriers of its own. Kind of an eye for an eye situation.
That very well may be true.
Derek Scissors is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and there is an if to all of this. The U.S. would indeed be hurt if other countries sued and won.
The problem for those countries is we're dealing with a possibly protectionist president who doesn't like the WTO. Do you really want to alienate the world's largest economy by suing them in the WTO?
Basically, other countries can take the U.S. to court, but the U.S. could take them to the alley behind the courthouse. And that can get nasty. Countries may not wait for the WTO, which can take 4 years or many more to resolve issues. They may just start retaliating right off the bat. And some in Europe have already signaled that's exactly what they'll do. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The South by Southwest Conference and Festivals, that's festivals plural because there's so much going on in Austin, Texas, is on right now. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood drew the tough duty. We got her on the phone from Austin to get a sense of what's happening down South by. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
First of all, what's the vibe? What's the scene at South by this year?
The scene at South by is that it's a scene, which is usually the case. it's interesting. I was lucky enough to fly into Austin just as the weather changed, because I think everybody had it sounds like by all accounts the first few days of this particular festival were pretty rough between weather and logistics issues. Just pure transportation, which, you know, listeners of our Make Me Smart podcast will have heard me make fun of people who are complaining about not being able to get an Uber or Lyft in Austin, but it turns out it's a pretty real issue.
Well, let's pick up on that a little bit, right? This is was in its earliest days almost a pure technology conference, and yet the city isn't doing business with Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and lots of stuff.
Yeah, I think that to me is a really interesting through line, is that here is this festival of celebrating ideas and trying to inform kind of the tech community about what's coming next. But Austin is a really quirky and unique place that has a complicated relationship with sort of on-demand technology. So last year, Uber and Lyft were operating in the city. They've now been shut down. And toward the end of this year, the city's going to phase out a lot of its short-term Airbnb rentals. And that makes up a lot of the housing for this festival. South by Southwest brings in just the interactive portion, which is the kind of tech event of this festival, brings in 70,000 people.
Phew.
By the time the music show starts, it's 150,000 people. So it's a massive logistical challenge. And if you look at other massive conferences, you know, they've made arrangements for that. The organization that puts on the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, they've worked directly with the city of Las Vegas to get Uber and Lyft in there so that it would be a more palatable conference. And as South by Southwest, you know, faces some troubles in terms of growth and newsmaking, I think it's a problem for them. I talked to Hugh Forrest. He's the director of programming for South by Southwest Interactive. And you can hear some resignation in his voice on this topic.
You know, would it be good for our event if Uber and Lyft were back in town? Yes. Would it be good for our event if Airbnb had a rosier future in Austin? Yes. But Austin is Austin. We do things in many different ways. That's part of the charm, the quirky charm of the city. So we'll see how it plays out.
That is a great piece of tape. You can hear the exasperation in his voice. That's an amazing piece of tape.
That's a tired guy right there. Yeah. That's a tired guy.
How long are you going to be there? Another couple of days?
So I'm here for a couple of days. The interactive portion is actually over. We're now technically into the music part of South by Southwest. But they added on a two-day summit, sort of trying to make themselves more relevant in new and creative ways. So there's a two-day summit that's all about tech and tech policy under the Trump administration. So I am moderating a panel on that topic, or on immigration in this track. But it's a way to kind of, you know, keep juicing interest in the interactive part, because as you know, it's been a long time since South by Southwest made any news.
Yeah. If you happen to be in Austin, go see Molly Wood doing her panel. Otherwise, you can hear her on the podcast that we do. It is called Make Me Smart. You can get it at our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
there isn't a monster driving people crazy or doing evil things, but other people.
True both in life and in the new movie, Get Out. But first, let's do the numbers. All interest rates today. The Dow Industrials rose 112 points, about 0.5%, 20,950. The Nasdaq climbed 43 points, about 0.7%, 5,900 on the nose. S&P 500 up 19 points, 0.8%, 23.85. Bank stocks mostly down, actually, following the Fed's move. Citigroup off 1%. Bank of America declined about 0.5%. Oil prices, a barometer sometimes for inflation, ticked up. Thus, energy stocks rebounded. Chevron rose 1.4% today. Chesapeake Energy climbed 4%. The dollar and gold also reflected the Fed's move. The Wall Street Journal's index of the dollar against other currencies down 1%. Gold surged 0.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.50%, which is another way of saying 2.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Probably the only thing higher than trade on the Trump administration's to-do list is immigration. The president has made it a priority to deport people here illegally who've been charged with a crime, even if those people haven't been convicted. And while immigration raids have gotten a lot of attention, there may be a much more efficient form of enforcement. A lot of California counties aren't cooperating with immigration officials, but the Fresno County Sheriff has taken a different approach, as Vanessa Roncagno reports.
Inside the Fresno County Jail, Sergeant Elisa Magallanes questions a newly arrested man through a glass barrier with a small window in it.
Are you a U.S. citizen? Yes? Okay.
She hands him a consent form that says ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, could ask to interview him in jail, but he has the right to say no.
Sometimes they'll ask me questions as far as am I getting deported, and I explain to them at this time, no.
More of a possibility here than in many California jails. The Fresno County Sheriff's Department gives ICE full access to inmates. Correctional Officer Isaac Torres shows me into a small interview room.
So once the ICE agent is here with the inmate, my staff will leave them here by themselves.
ICE also gets access to the jail's database with information collected at booking, plus any details about charges and criminal history. Edgar Torres, no relation to the officer, found himself in that interview room last summer, facing a man wearing a badge. I talked to him over Skype.
He said, "Do you know who I am?" I said, "No." He said, "I'm ICE."
The agent knew Torres was undocumented and pushed him to sign an agreement to leave the country voluntarily.
I didn't want to just give up. I have my family in Fresno. I wanted to fight for them.
Torres has a misdemeanor conviction for domestic violence. He went to jail because he didn't finish his court-mandated classes. ICE agents met with him 3 times and eventually put him in an immigration detention facility. When it was clear he wasn't going to win his case, he signed a voluntary removal order. He's back in Mexico now. His wife and 2 daughters are still in California. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims invited ICE into her jail 2 years ago.
My perspective, it truly is a win-win.
Other California sheriffs have followed her lead, including Kern and Stanislaus counties.
It keeps people from being released back into our communities that have committed crimes, many times multiple crimes. And it keeps ICE in our jail, and they don't have to go out into the community, which raises fear among people that ICE may not be looking for.
But critics say this collaboration may make people less likely to cooperate with local law enforcement if they fear deportation. Saira Hussein is an attorney with the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco.
When the message that's being sent from the administration to local law enforcement is like, we want you to help us deport people, I'd say that Fresno's already sort of setting that path to really just unfettered cooperation.
California already limits how police can work with immigration authorities, but the state legislature is weighing a bill that would tighten things further. The California Values Act would bar Fresno or any sheriff's department from dedicating any resources to immigration enforcement. And it would stop them from letting ICE into the jail to do interviews. In Fresno, I'm Vanessa Rancagno from Marketplace.
Past couple of weeks, I've seen a lot of foot traffic at the local multiplex King Kong Skull Island. Logan, Beauty and the Beast opens this week, for which advanced ticket sales have already hit a record. But the box office story of the year so far is a horror movie called Get Out, written and directed by Jordan Peele. It cost about $5 million to make so far. It's done more than $113 million in tickets. That's a record debut for an African-American writer-director. And it has brought with it a conversation about race and society in this country. Wesley Morris writes on film and culture and a bunch of stuff for the New York Times. Hey, Wesley.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, we talked 3 years ago, you and I. I went back and looked it up. And we talked about 2013 having been a good year for black filmmakers and for audiences wanting to see films by, for, and with people of color. Are we now at fruition with Get Out and Hidden Figures and Moonlight and all that?
I mean, we're somewhere near there. I mean, look, let's see where we are in 6 months from now. I don't know what else is in the pipeline. I don't see a lot. But I think, you know, what the movie studios know and what they always know, but they kind of ignore, which is that there's an audience for movies like Get Out and Hidden Figures and to some extent Moonlight, which made a lot less money than Hidden Figures did. But, I mean, for a movie that cost $1.5 million to make, you know, making $25 million is, I think, an accomplishment.
So listen, I'm not going to see Get Out because it's a scary movie, and I don't do scary, as I think I've said a bunch of times. But obviously, it's amazing. And the thing I want to ask you about, based on what I've read, but the thing I want to ask you about is a conversation you had with Jordan Peele, the filmmaker, on the podcast you do for the New York Times, you and Jenna Wortham, called Still Processing. You had him on, and he said, the monster in this film is societal. It's a social thriller, which I thought was a great line.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's interesting about this movie is there is no monster in it. It is basically just the way we treat each other. I think there are, I know white people who've seen this movie and have been surprised by the way that racism functions, in that it's not the obvious way that they've been told racism works. It's all, I mean, the villain isn't just racism, it's institutional racism.
Do you, and this is radio and people might not know, you're a black guy.
I am an African-American man, yes.
Yeah, and I guess my question is, and this is way far afield, but I'm just going to roll with it. Do you get sick and tired of having to have this conversation about the way black people are perceived in this country?
No. I mean, that's a really good question, Kai. You and I talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
I talk about it with a lot of the people in my life. I'd rather talk about it than not talk about it. I think one of the problems with the way things have been in this country for a while is that we aren't really talking about the thing that we all know, or lots of people of color know, is going on, and white people are often catching up with that. One of the heartening things about the money this movie has made is, in order to make this kind of money, you kind of need some white people to go,
which means there is a white audience for this movie, and the racism in it is so subtle, and the subtlety of the racism is so obvious that I think it is informing a certain white audiences about a kind of behavior that they might be participating in and weren't previously aware of.
So you said also in the podcast where you had Jordan Peele on, you said you hope this film is in the conversation next year at the Oscars. And I guess just as a follow-on to my earlier question, are you looking forward to or are you dreading the conversations that will happen if this movie does well at the Oscars or is nominated or is in the conversation?
Nah, I mean, I think it won't change too much based on the conversation we're having right now about it. Not you and I, but just the country
the
in general.
One,
and I think it's also really important to say that the odds of this movie doing anything at the Oscars are really low, given the kind of movie it is. But it also is a movie that is immediately in a class with, given its subject matter, with Rosemary's Baby, with Night of the Living Dead, with any number of movies that also take on this idea that there isn't a monster driving people crazy or doing evil things, but other people.
Wesley Morris, he writes on movies and culture and all kinds of stuff for the New York Times. Thanks, Wesley. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, 19,902,604,401,673.92. That is the total outstanding public debt of these United States. I mention it because the government's authority to borrow more money, most commonly referred to as the debt limit or the debt ceiling, expires tomorrow. Thus, you will start seeing a fresh round of will the government default or won't it stories. It won't. There, saved you a click. On this Fed day, the Dow up 112 points, about a half percent, 20,950. The S&P 500 up 43 points, 0.7%, 5,900 on the nose. The S&P 500 up 19 points, 0.8%, 2,385. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.